Thanks for spending time with Fusion Community Church through our podcast. These can be accessed anytime through iTunes or on our website, fusioncommunitychurch.org. We hope you enjoy today's message from Pastor Andrew Fetter.
Incredible thing that's going on here at Fusion, and we're excited that everyone's here, and maybe you're here for the first time, and you got some crazy invite from somebody, you keep getting it, and you're finally like, I got to get them off my back, I'm just going to go. So we're glad you're here. It's our hope that today, whatever ideas or thoughts you come through the door with today, that God begins to help you see Him. This isn't about Fusion, this isn't about me, this isn't about us, it's all about Jesus and what He's done. Now, this video was only going to be about 60 seconds, and it was going to actually capture a lot of the superhero movies, just little snippets and clips of the Avengers and Batman and Superman, and just kind of touching on our culture's obsession with superheroes. Chances are you've probably seen one of those movies. Maybe you're like me, and you've seen them all, and you'll rush out to see the next one. But our culture really is focused and revolves around, and our money is being spent in droves, not only on the movies or the films, the TV shows, the comic books, but the toys and the accessories and the clothing and the costumes. I mean, your kids are probably going to be begging you to be Captain America and Thor and Iron Man this Halloween, right? Well, from Avengers to Justice League or even zombies now, our culture has this obsession with superheroes. And I think one of the reasons for that obsession is we are drawn to heroic acts of courage or valor or sacrifice or love. And when you add incredible abilities beyond human limitations to it, and let's just be honest, you blow up a lot of stuff on the screen, it draws the attention of many guys. You add things like super strength, power to fly, creative genius. And we kind of surrender billions of dollars at the movie theater and at the toy store. Today, we've set aside this moment, this Sunday, not to talk about fictional heroes, but to honor real heroes, real acts of courage, real decisions of ongoing sacrifice, consistent commitments, based on many that are in this room, on the role you play within our community, where you're consistent and reliable. And today, our simple goal is to say thank you, is to honor you, those in this room that make a impact, a difference in our lives day in and day out. Now, it's fun to go into the movies. It's fun to kind of step out of our real world and into a fictional world for 2 hours or so and experience heroic decisions that impact and save and change people's lives or even save the planet because of these incredible abilities these superheroes have. But whenever you do that, keep in mind, everything you're seeing on the screen, even though emotionally you feel like it's spinning out of control, it's all been designed. There's a director, there's a script writer, those are actors. They've put together a package in condensed form, a story with three acts where they introduce you, then they create tension, and then they resolve the tension near the end of the movie, and emotionally you get to breathe again in the midst of all the climax of the story. It is dramatic. It looks like it's spinning out of control, but it is all precisely timed with a score, with sound effects, with graphics. It's not real. And if we really step out of the movie theater and back into real life, we can identify it's far more inspiring and courageous to reflect upon the daily commitments and sacrifices made by so many in this room. We have the banners up kind of across the front to highlight these four categories. For those in education, you know, the preparation you make week in and week out, night in and night out, the late hours, the staying after school to assist those who are struggling, to teach or to instruct, the nights you spend grading papers that seem like they will never end, the relentless hope that the time and energy and attention you're pouring into students is actually going to help shape their future, that they're actually eventually going to get it, they're going to be able to understand it, and they're going to develop a passion for that subject the way that you do. For those who maybe work in the offices or as administrators, you deal with all the behind-the-scenes details required of a school district. Oftentimes, the roles that don't get as much attention are not as visible and yet so necessary so that our kids are safe, so that they're in an atmosphere that is conducive to learning. Then there's all those that manage all the logistics of a school system, of a school district with facilities and transportation and maintenance that seems to never end. And then there's those who make sure that our kids have something to eat each day. There's those that serve in the public service sector. those who when we have an emergency, when we have a crisis and we dial those three numbers, we know that we hope we never have to dial on our phone, 911, that there's someone there on the other end that answers. That whenever we have an emergency, someone's going to show up, not knowing exactly what they're going to expect when they arrive, but they're ready and prepared to handle any and all circumstances when they arise. Maybe there's going to be a fire. Maybe there's someone that needs to be detained because they're out of control. Maybe that weapon on your side is going to need to be utilized. Maybe there was a car accident. You have no idea what you're driving up on, what's going to be the state of the situation ahead of you. And maybe there's someone that's going to be hanging on to life by a thread, and your training and preparation and your ability to be courageous and focused under pressure will be the difference between someone's life or death. For others in public service, many of you serve our community in ways that maybe aren't quite as visible or glamorous or received. Detail-oriented ways that often go forgotten until some goof like me calls looking for answers and bounces around from office to office to find the person whose entire focus in life and career is that area that's going to answer the issue that I've been faced with. You're providing the answer that we're looking for. Maybe you serve in our community and you provide a service, you meet a need that otherwise wouldn't be met. Then there's those in the military, those who we recognize regularly, who when we see someone in uniform, it catches our attention. Those who are willing from a very young age to lay down their life for people, most of whom they'll probably never meet. Because you believe in our country, you believe in the gift of freedom that we have, and you're willing to sacrifice personally, your family's willing to sacrifice personally so we can preserve these gifts that so often, if we're honest, we take for granted. And we know that you've served alongside men and women, some who have given their lives. We know that you've served alongside men and women who, as a result of their on-the-ground combat, are now dealing with major life-changing disabilities as a result of the injuries they sustained, or who return from combat with psychological struggles of adjusting back to normal life. And then there's those in the medical fields. You know, the way in which television often paints doctors and nurses is that every single episode is scripted as a heroic act. That in a matter of really, without the commercials, 41 or 42 minutes, there is a major crisis that rises to the surface and an entire life, an entire family, an entire world is changed. There's this massive heroic act, and it seems like as though half of everything on television now happens in a hospital. But perhaps every day you go to work kind of feeling that way. Maybe you enjoy the shows that take place in medical settings. And you yourself work in a hospital or in a private practice or a dentist's office or a veterinarian's office, and maybe you feel heroic every day when you go to work and you come home, like your life really made a difference and made an impact and you saved someone's life. My assumption is television is kind of sensationalized, and that's probably not how you feel every day. But today we want to say thank you, because when we know that something is off, when we're not feeling right, when our kids aren't feeling right or acting right, or when we have an emergency, we have a place to go, and we have people there that are waiting to sit with us, to listen with us, to try to figure this out for us, to serve us, to wait on us, helping to change our circumstances and restore our health. But we also know that those in the medical community can't do what they do unless there are those behind the scenes providing the details and logistics needed. We're so blessed as a nation, aren't we, to have these four areas operating to us as a people. And when we reflect on human history and the nation we live in today, we live in a time where the professions and trainings and passions that we get to experience on a daily, weekly, monthly basis as a community, when we compare what we have exposure to in these four areas, it is still rare when compared with the most of human history and even most of the world and the population on this planet. Most people on planet Earth are not privileged enough to receive the benefit of services like these with people so readily available and willing and passionate to meet our needs. You know, families in most parts of the world only dream of their children getting any kind of education. People in desperate need through crisis hardly even can dream of an infrastructure that exists in their nation to provide protection or law enforcement or first responders that show up or legal systems that help to provide for them or protect them or guide them. There's people in many parts of the world that can't imagine a military that isn't corrupt and self-focused, looking at power rather than selfless and looking to guard and to protect. And throughout most of the world, access to simple medical personnel or medicine, even in its simplest form, in so many parts of the world, is almost impossible to get your hands on. Heroism is only possible because of heroic decisions made by ordinary people, made by individuals willing to risk themselves for the benefit of others. As a church, we focus our attention towards the Bible for direction in life, for guidance for living, for wisdom, to find God in the midst of the pages of Scripture, and yet also to see applications that apply in our lives today. And today, we're going to center in on one life of a person who made a significant impact in their world some 2,500, 2,600 years ago. There's one person who seemed like they were positioned for influence, like they had a title that mattered, that they could make a difference in the world, and yet the title actually indicated something in that culture that meant this person was silenced. The title in our world today seems to be one of great influence and great authority. In this world, this title actually meant that they were silenced. Not silent, but they didn't have permission to speak. I want to set the stage for this heroic decision that this one person made that put their life on the line, that made a difference for an entire people group, an entire ethnicity. If you're familiar with the events that play out in history recorded in the early portions of the Bible, you might be aware that the Hebrew people, the Israelites, the nation of Israel, named after the grandson of Father Abraham, who had many sons. Father Abraham had many sons had Father Abraham. I'm one of them, so are you. You're welcome. It's going to be in your head the rest of the day. The grandson of Father Abraham, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel because the nation of Israel would be born out of his lineage. God gave them a land that he had promised to them. But it wasn't land that was vacant. It was land that was already occupied. See, the people who had inhabited this promised land before God was going to hand it over to the Israelites, they were filled with evil. So God was about to remove control from the people that lived there and entrust it in the hands of the Hebrew people. But God warned them. He said if they chose to turn their backs on him, if they chose to follow in the footsteps of the current residents that existed in the promised land, then God would also judge them and take the land from them. If they didn't prove they could be trusted to steward this land, then it would be removed from them. And that's exactly what took place. A few generations later, a neighboring nation, a neighboring empire, the Babylonians, came to the surface and they conquered the Israelites. It was after them, a few generations, that the Persians came in and then conquered the Babylonians, and kind of at the mercy of all of this are these Israelites that at once were given the promised land by the hand of God. And yet here they once again find themselves enslaved and oppressed. It's here where we begin to discover our hero come to the surface, one of the five following individuals. The first person I want to introduce you to is King Xerxes. King Xerxes was the Persian king. With this whole heroes thing, I'm going to give you some comic books to kind of view as we go through it. His wife, I don't have a picture of her, but the queen's name was Vashti. And this was not a marriage, king and queen, based on love. No. In this culture, the men believed that what defined them, what gave them value, what gave them stature, what gave them worth, was rooted in their position, in their power, in their title, in their wealth. And the women believed in this culture that their identity, that their worth was rooted not in their courage, not in their compassion, not in their character, but really the greatest worth you could have was based upon your sex appeal, was based on your appearance. And aren't you glad that after 2,600 years of human history, we have evolved so far beyond those primitive and broken perspectives? See, this reminds us of just the incredible power of God's Word. It's not so much these things happened as historical events that are captured. As much as it is, it reminds us that they're still happening. That there's still were the things that we struggle with that if we aren't careful, we can lose sight of. Now, this peaks in that one night, these difference between men's roles and women's roles, men's value and women's value, King Xerxes is hosting a party, and Scripture tells us that he was drunk. He summons his wife, who he saw as his property, and he wants her to come out and parade in front of all of his friends so that they can see how valuable she is because of how stunning she was. So a servant goes back into Vashti's quarters and tells her the king's command that we want you to parade out here in front. Basically, the king wants his wife to come out so that all of his buddies can lust after her like a piece of meat. She resists Xerxes' command. This ultimately led to King Xerxes removing her as queen. He had absolute power. And because she was unwilling to do what he told her to do, not what he asked her to do, what he told her to do, because she wasn't compliant in his command, He removed her from the role of queen overnight. This led to then a problem. After he removes Queen Vashti, now there's a vacancy in that role. It's time to begin interviewing new candidates. And as you can guess, Xerxes was not interested in finding a woman who was courageous or compassionate or full of character. He was interested in the same thing that so often our culture paints as the only thing that matters for a woman, which often feeds into the insecurity many women in this room feel, as well as your kids and grandkids, your daughters and granddaughters, plagued from childhood with this constant feeling of not good enough, not pretty enough, because of such a demand on vanity and appearance. So as a result of Xerxes beginning to scour the empire for the replacement queen, a harem, or a term we may be more common with today, as a brothel, is set up in the city of Susa. And people from across the Persian Empire were sent out into every province to find the most beautiful girls, the most beautiful virgins, and take them to this brothel. Not invite them, not welcome them, not request them, take them to this brothel. It was there they would spend the next year preparing for their opportunity to interview to be the new queen of Persia. Now let's just be clear, this was human trafficking some 2.5 millennia ago, where women would be taken from their homes and their families and placed in a brothel for 12 months to prepare to interview with the king. It's here where we meet a man named Mordecai. He was a Jewish man who still had faith that God was present, that God cared, God saw the struggles of the people of Israel, and God had a plan to rescue them. He had adopted the daughter of his cousin who had passed away when this little girl was young. So he raised this girl, Hadassah, as his own, or as you might know her today as Esther. He raised Esther as his own daughter. Xerxes was looking for the woman with sex appeal that would rival his former queen, who would be compliant to do whatever it is that he said. But how he would select his wife and how he would interview her was even worse than really we can possibly begin to imagine. In Esther chapter 2, it says this: before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her, and he summoned her by name. Esther was one of the young women who were taken from her home to go and spend 1 year in this brothel preparing to be essentially raped by the king. Now, this is an opportunity for some personal reflection, especially if you have a daughter. I mean, I have 3 of them. Imagine the authorities coming in, dragging your daughter out the door, knowing that she's going to be taken to a brothel where for 12 months she's going to know she's waiting for her turn to be taken sexually by force. Ultimately, Esther's night with the king came, and the king actually was most satisfied by her, and she was selected to be the next queen. Now, we don't have enough time to get into the details of Esther's life and everything she faced, as well as the Jewish people faced at this point in history, but you can tell, even though she was assigned the title of queen, oftentimes we have assumptions about that title. She experienced so much heartbreak in her life, losing her parents when she was a child, being adopted by her parents' cousin, being used at a young age, being viewed as property. Yeah, she was given the title of king and or queen and lived in the lap of luxury beyond what we could possibly imagine, but she was silenced. She had no permission to speak, no permission to lead. And as if the culture wasn't evil enough based on the way they viewed men and women, the evil didn't stop at the king and his role. There were men in positions of power and authority who were very insecure, and that led to the abuse of the power and authority that they had. Like King Xerxes' second in command, a man named Haman. You see, a truth surfaces here when we get close to this man named Haman that is still true today. When you take an insecure person who only feels important when they have authority other over people, and then you actually give them that kind of authority, it always results in abuse. Always. Haman is insecure. He has a deep longing to be significant, and the only way he can get that itch scratched is when he sits in a position of incredible power. And since he sits as second in command to King Xerxes. It results in him using his power to feel better about himself, to pad his ego. So a law is presented that requires that when anyone is in the presence of Haman, they have to bow and they have to show physically their submission to him so his ego can be puffed up. However, there's one man that refuses to obey this law, the man Mordecai, the Jewish man. Now, we don't quite know if it was a personal decision or a faith-based decision to not bow to this man Haman, but he refused to bow and show submission to this man who was evil. He was not going to bow to his pride and his ego. Ultimately, this leads to Haman despising Mordecai, so much so that he wants to kill him. But more than just kill Mordecai, he wants to kill his entire race, everybody that Mordecai represents, the Jewish people. So to sum up what happens, let me just tell you that second in command tricks King Xerxes into creating a law that says any Persian that wants to can kill a Jewish person and take all of their belongings for them for themselves. Basically, I mean, this is, you know, hunting season. He has open season on Jewish men and women that anyone that wants to can, if you see something they like, you have legal protection to kill them and take whatever it is that they have. When Esther finds out about it, even though she's in the palace, far removed from suffering, when Mordecai communicates this rule that's been established by Haman, Esther's now presented with a decision to make. At this point, no one knows she's Jewish. She hasn't been as vocal as some like Ezra or Nehemiah or Mordecai about their ethnicity and their faith. Maybe she's not practicing her faith at this point, obeying the Jewish law like many others that would have, so it wouldn't have kind of been seen. In a way, maybe she's compromising her faith and she's not, it doesn't have priority over her life, but now she's presented with a challenge. She's wrestling now with the consequences. Do I say something or do I say nothing? What are the consequences of speaking up? What are the consequences of staying silent? And what might the king do if she chooses to put her life on the line and speak? I want you to listen to Mordecai's challenge and his faith in the words that he shares with Queen Esther at this point. She has a choice to make a cowardly decision or a courageous decision, to blend in with the crowd and only think about herself, or to lay her life on the line heroically, not knowing what the outcome might be. Mordecai says, "Do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." I love his faith in that statement. "But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Doesn't this communicate Mordecai's perspective beautifully? It paints the depth of his faith in the God of Israel. He flat out tells Esther, "Yes, you're queen. Yes, you're in a position. Yes, right now you don't have influence or authority or power, but you are in the presence of the king. You can choose to speak up. But let me be clear about this, Esther. All of this does not depend upon you." His faith in God, so often, I think for us, if we were in Mordecai's position, we'd want to kind of try to manipulate her or control her or convince her or persuade her. "Look, there's nobody else. If you don't do this, no one else will. If you don't do this, I will die. If you don't do this, all of us will die." Mordecai doesn't paint this picture as if she has no other choice, but she presents this choice of obedience or disobedience. And he says, "Hey, here's the deal. It doesn't all depend on you. It depends on God. But you have a choice to make. You can be the one God uses profoundly to rescue his people. And maybe, just maybe, you were put in this position for such a time as this." It's clear to see Mordecai's faith does not rest in the title given by worldly assignment. He doesn't rest in whatever role that Esther might play in the Persian palace. He rests his faith in God, knowing that God can pick and choose many different instruments to be the catalyst of his plans. So he tells this girl who he's raised as his daughter, "Perhaps this is the whole reason that God allowed you to rise to this position of prominence as queen for this day, to make a heroic decision that will preserve the future of your life, of my life, and of our entire people." Esther then sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And get this, if I perish, I perish. Now, I want to encourage you today, this week, to visit the book of Esther in the Bible. It's one of the 66 books. Sometimes we think the Bible is written by one person at one point in history from one perspective. Some people think the Bible was written by Jesus. No, Jesus didn't write a word of it. The Bible is made up of 66 books written by over 40 different people over a course of about 1,500 years of history. So it's incredible the diversity of the Bible. It's unlike any other compilation or book that we have from history. And the number of original texts we have to source the content that goes back thousands of years is just staggering. But I want to encourage you to visit the book of Esther and read it. It's one of great suspense. It's one of great intrigue. I mean, it's a book, there's some humor to it. I really encourage you can read it in one sitting in a matter of, 15, 20 minutes. Because I don't have enough time, and we're not doing a whole series on the book of Esther and all the details and events of this extraordinary woman willing to put her life on the line, willing to sacrifice. But if we were to step into her sandals, for most of us in this room, it would be hard to imagine what she's experienced. I believe in a room this size with this many people, there are women that could step right into her sandals and say, I know exactly what she went through, exactly. Maybe you'd even say what I went through was far worse than even what she experienced. That could very well be the case. But what's amazing about the details of her life is, do we see a life filled with accidents and coincidence? Or in the midst of heartbreak, do we still see God's hand at work in the situations of her life? Now, I'm not saying God is the cause of her heartache. That's not what Scripture points out. But God always seems to be there, and maybe He's been there in your life at a point where it seems like you're falling. God has made Himself faithful, and He's always constantly there for you to lean on, even through the heartbreak. In the end of Esther's true story, God turns the table on evil. Haman's plot is discovered and he is eliminated by Xerxes. He's executed while the children of God are rescued from the fate of annihilation. And one of the things that's most remarkable about Esther's story as we reflect on it is that it's a portrait that's perfect of what would happen just a few hundred years later when Jesus shows up on the scene. He would be the one to step up and lay his life on the line, lay his life on the cross to sacrifice for all those who would choose to say yes to him as God's perfect victory over evil. Jesus turns the table on evil. He identifies with us. He steps into creation and makes our problems his problems. And at the moment of decision in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he could make a choice, wasn't forced, he could make a choice to allow his life to be given or to walk away and stay in comfort. He made the hard choice, not the easy one. He made the heroic decision. And in so doing, died the death on the cross, where he turned defeat into triumph. He turned agony into victory. He's the one who takes death and turns it into life. Jesus' example is him aligning with us in our suffering. Esther's example is one of heroism, aligning herself with the suffering of her people, even though she could have stayed silent. Both accounts give us the challenge to remember that the reason we choose to risk our lives for others is because Jesus already risked his life. He gave his life for me and for you. Now, if you're here today because someone invited you, or for any other reason you're here today, for the very first time, we want you to know that God, He does love you. He does care about what's happening in your life. Even if you look at your life and you're like, man, things are pretty good, God cares. Even if you look at your life and you're like, man, my situation right now is worse than Esther's, God cares. And we as a church care as well. We don't want you to just kind of pop through the doors on a Sunday and go about the week and hope everything works out for you in the rest of your life. No. We believe that our role as a church here is to be engaged and investing in the lives of people throughout our communities. And today, one of those is to just kind of honor those who have made heroic decisions, who have made the focus of their life, their career, their passion or burden, other people's needs ahead of their own. But I want to point your attention to something on our communication card. If you would pull that out, Kathy mentioned it at the beginning of our worship. Just pull out that little colored card. It's about a third of a piece of paper. And just take a look at the backside. There's a line there that should say something about, I have questions about Jesus. I need to talk to somebody about Jesus. Now, I want to kind of expand that Maybe you have things that you've always wondered about faith, about God, about the Bible, about Jesus himself, about other faith practices, maybe about your own tradition. I want to encourage you, I would be honored if you would check that box and you can drop it in the offering basket at the end of our worship experience today. I would be honored to sit down and just kind of have a dialogue with you because, and I'll promise you, I don't have all the answers, but I know who is the answer. And I would love to share my story of what he's done in my life with you, just face to face, eyeball to eyeball. Now, as a church, we've been in the middle of a 90-day devotional challenge. We're calling it going one-on-one with Christ. By diving into God's Word, spending one-on-one time with him every single day. And I was just amazed in yesterday's reading how it was so evident that God is not a God of coincidence, but he is a God of design. And I think this is a great segue into the next portion of our worship today. Yesterday, the verse that was presented was Romans 10, 9 and 10. Can we put that up on the screen? This is the day before for us as a church going through a 90-day tithe challenge. Listen to how this paints the picture and sets the stage for us today, honoring those in our community. It says, love must be honest and true. Hate what is evil. Hold on to what is good. Love one another deeply. And honor others more than you honor yourselves. Today, if you've been invited to join us, whether you're a part of our church on a regular basis or we've kind of expanded this to be an invite to our community as a whole, and someone's invited you and you've been uneasy or uncomfortable about this whole thing, one thing I know about these four areas is that normally people that serve in those roles don't really like recognition, don't like to hear thank you, don't like to be given attention. We're not going to invite you up on stage or anything like that. We did that the first year and learned our lesson. We're not going to go that route again. We're not going to have you talking to a mic. But we do believe that it's important, not for you to hear it, but for us to say it. Amen? It's important for us to say thank you. Do you think we're good? All right, the update's over. So we'll roll this next video.